Time now for a conversation about climate change, featuring experts from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for this special Climate Week podcast. I'm Greg Husak, your host. I'll ask our guests to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Kenny Blumenfeld. I'm a climatologist with the DNR State Climatology Office, and I do a lot of outreach on the science of climate change in Minnesota especially. And I also manage a network of weather stations that we use to monitor the climate around Minnesota.
Hello, my name is Luigi Romolo. I am the Minnesota State Climatologist with the Minnesota State Climatology Office, and my work centers around two areas of focus, and those involve climate service and data management.
And I'm sure people listening may well be familiar with your voices and hearing and seeing your comments about climate here in Minnesota over the years, but particularly as we, during this climate week and looking forward as we talk about some of the specifics that are going on, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what you do. You gave us a taste of that, but also the difference between climate and weather, because I think that's a question that a lot of people get hung up on.
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's a question that climatologists get almost every day. And so the best way to think about it is weather is the day-to-day variations of temperature and precipitation. And over a long period, approximately 30 years, if you average it, you get climatology. So if you have over 30 years of data at a particular location, then you could estimate or guesstimate what you might expect from the day-to-day variations in weather. So when you hear a forecaster say the high today might be 74, but the normal is 72, the 74 is the weather, the 72 is the climate.
And Kenny, maybe you want to expand on that a little bit too, as it relates to some of what we hear from people talking about, well, what do you mean? It's, you know, 15 degrees below zero today. How can this indicate, you know, people tend to get very specific about.
Well, so another handy, this is really convenient for us because, you know, also weather is usually when we think of it, meteorology is about tomorrow or next week. And climatology traditionally has been about the past. Now, there's a whole branch of it that's focused on the future too because of the changing climate that we want to try and get a scientific understanding of. But if we just think about the difference between forecasting weather over the next few days or looking backwards and analyzing the climate as Luigi described it, one of the real advantages is that you hear the joke sometimes, oh, meteorologists are wrong, you know, half the time. And well, we're climatologists and we're just talking about what already happened, so we're right 100% of the time.
Correct.
You're in a more comfortable position now.
Yeah. In terms of you know, one of the things that we try and, you know, we're a scientific organization, a science-based organization, and we are also committed to educating our users. And so one of the things that we try and help people realize, which they can already intuit, is that the climate of Minnesota is wild. It's highly variable. It can be hot. It can be cold. It can go from hot to cold in a relatively short amount of time. And that's always been true, and that's probably always going to be true. But at the same time, there are these systematic changes, these trends in the temperatures that we've observed, these trends in precipitation that we've observed. And what that means is we have now a statistical, scientific basis for knowing that it's gotten wetter or that it's gotten warmer. And even while that's happening, we still have the ups and the downs. So, of course, we're still going to have that 15 below, even as our winters get warmer. It's just that maybe the frequency of those 15 belows is going down, which we've actually seen. And, you know, maybe it doesn't get as far below zero as it used to. And that's also something we've seen. So we still can get wild swings and we're still going to get cold. And the fact that we're warming doesn't disprove the, you know, doesn't mean that we'll never get cold again. And the fact that we get cold last week doesn't mean that we're not warming.
As we stretch out our thinking then and think more in terms of, you know, 30, 40, 50 years and beyond, for each of you, what are one or two of the key statistics that you cite when you look at how climate is changing more rapidly in Minnesota?
Yeah, so I think what Kenny's talked about with many of our media contacts that we've had throughout the year, one of the biggest issues that we're seeing right now is an increase in the extreme rainfall events that are occurring here in Minnesota, with a 20% increase in the number of 1-inch rains, a 65% increase in the number of 3-inch rainfall events. And these have profound impacts on rural communities with farming practices, and they have profound impacts in urban communities that are witnessing and observing strains to their infrastructure system. And probably the biggest observed impact here in Minnesota that we've seen so far.
Yeah, you want to say, so one of the things that we get, and someone might ask, well, what's a 1-inch rainfall? Who cares? And it is true, an inch of rain in a day in and of itself is not a big deal. It will ruin your picnic. Mm-hmm. You won't play softball that night. Mm-hmm. But if in normal conditions, it's not that big a deal. But if you've been already wet, and I think what Luigi's kind of referring to, if you've already been wet or you're in an environment like a city, you can probably explain it better than me, where it's really hard to handle an inch of rain if it's already wet or if there's nowhere for the water to go. But especially if you get, instead 3 inches of rain. And it's not like these are happening everywhere. It's just that they're becoming more common in general. So the increases that we've seen, it doesn't mean every place in Minnesota every day of every year is going to get bombarded by some, massive rainfall event. Mm-hmm. It just means that, the kinds of images you see of standing water, ponding water, submerged intersections, flooded basements, things like that, those are becoming more common. And not just because of more cameras to mm-hmm. take pictures of right. it, but because, they're actually more common.
Well, and certainly here in 2019, and again, trying to not just go by one snapshot, but people have been talking all year about the sustained high water conditions across much of the state, and that your indications are that that this will be a trend over the next 50 years that is expected to continue and to increase.
Yeah. So all the models are pointing in that direction. And so what we need to figure out is how to adapt to be able to essentially deliver this water efficiently through better infrastructure, better planned agricultural activity, and basically adapt in the best way possible.
And our floodplain planning, floodplain management planning,
correct.
And urban planning certainly come into the mix very much.
Absolutely.
As well.
So anything that we can mitigate is going to help us, or anything that we can do can help us mitigate those disasters yeah. down the road.
Yeah, it's actually kind of confusing sometimes too, because we have a trend towards wetter conditions. But the kind of wetness that we've had in 2019, 18, 17, and 16 is above that trend line, right? So one of the challenges of doing the work that we do is we have to try and, if audiences really want the information, we have to say, well, yeah, we're on this trend towards wetter conditions. But that variation, the variability that we also talked about, we're really high on that curve right now too. So we have this trend. Plus, we have what must be this period of very high variability mm-hmm. wetness, because we've never really seen anything like this. I mean, how many years, Luigi, are we, we're talking year after year where we're breaking some kind of pretty significant precipitation record mm-hmm. in the state. And what's Rochester as of late September already?
Yeah, around 44 inches.
Already broke its all-time annual
yeah,
precipitation.
Yeah, and we're here in the metro, we're on pace to break the record that was set just 2 years ago.
Right, and up in yeah. northwest Minnesota, we just, after almost a whole year where they were kind of lagging behind, northwest yep. Minnesota was kind of looking at southern Minnesota saying, well, what's the big deal? It's not that wet. Well, then they get 5 to 7 inches of rain, correct, and they know what everyone's, you know, yeah, what everyone's talking, yeah, about.
Sure. And as you talk about these ups and downs, does this mean then that in seeing these sustained high water levels and more extreme rainfall events, does that mean that we're not going to be experiencing drought in Minnesota?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And so we have what's called interannual variability, which is the variation of our weather from year to year, wet year, dry year, wet year, wet year, dry year, and so forth. And it just goes on and on and on. But we also have these long-term climate trends. And as Kenny was indicating, we're on a wetter trend right now. And we're projected to increase our amount of precipitation as we move forward in time. But drought is not dependent on, well, in this part of the world, it's not so much dependent on the long-term trends, but rather on the interannual variability. Mm-hmm. So no matter how wet we get, the soil can only hold so much water. And when it's holding all the water that it can, we call that field capacity. So any surplus water is just going to run off into the streams and rivers or percolate down into groundwater and fill our groundwater reserves. And so really only ever about 4 to 5 weeks of dryness away from drought. And it's unlike other hazards, it doesn't have a season. It doesn't have a distinct start to it. It creeps up on you. And no matter how wet we get, drought's always going to be right around the corner. And an example is down in New Orleans, they get about 60 inches of rainfall a year, and they still experience drought. Hmm. Yeah.
Would you say, I mean, one of the things that we talk about with temperature, and I assume it's true with precipitation, is that if we're getting warmer, we're still going to get cold sometimes. And what we're seeing with the cold is, yeah, it's not as extreme and not as frequent as it used to be, but we still get cold. The late winter of 2019, wow, that was a real winter. And that we expect that for climatologically, that wasn't surprising. But I think if you get too used to this notion that it's only going to be warm winters for the rest of, mm-hmm, you know, for eternity now, then you will be really surprised by that. And I think the same is true for drought. We are certainly, I mean, we're on this pretty massive wet trend, but it would actually be irresponsible for us to assume that we wouldn't get drought.
Yeah, correct. So the thing that drives drought is the two meat and potato variables in meteorology. It's temperature and precipitation. And we're experiencing a warming trend and we're experiencing a wetter trend. So if temperature was going up and precip was going down, then the issue of drought would probably be a larger issue. But because precip is going up and temperature is going up as well, we don't know what's going to happen. We have no clear view of how drought is going to be affected by climate change. And that's a scary thought.
Well, and I want to ask a question about that, but also something related to this whole measure of all these data that you're working with here. We held a Twitter town hall at the DNR this week on climate change, and we were hearing a lot of talk about a point of no return. And along with that question and whether we've reached that in some respects, it should be apparent to anybody listening here, I think, that you're not pushing an agenda. You're citing scientific data. You're citing statistics and hard data here, and this is the world in which you work. But along with a question about a point of no return, what do you say, Kenny and Luigi, when you go out, and I know you do lots of presentations around the state during the year, what do you say to people who deny the notion of human-driven climate change?
Ooh, okay, can we take these one at a time?
Let's break
them
down.
Can we take these one,
yes,
at a time?
Yes.
You know, I think, so whenever I'm out talking, we get that kind of point of no return question, and it becomes, you know, I don't want to use too big, it becomes existential at some point where we are asking, well, what do we mean? And return from what and to what? Mm-hmm. What is it that, is there some pieces, is there some sort of idealistic climate point that we think we want to go back to? And so the question, as I think Luigi pointed out during that town hall, is, you know, it kind of depends on what you're looking at. For some things, we've already, you know, it's going to be hard to get them back. When you look at the rate of ice cover loss, for example, in the Arctic, it's going to be really hard to change that because the quality of ice has changed, and it's going to take hundreds of years to sort of redo that. There are other things where you know, depending where we do have time. And actually, Minnesota, for as dire as some of our climate signals are, we're actually sitting relatively pretty compared to some of our neighbors. I mean, think of California. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll let Luigi respond to the kind of point of no return question before we talk about this other piece.
All right.
And again, whenever Kenny or I or Pete go out and give a talk, we always get great questions like these. And some scientists are sometimes afraid to say, I don't know. And I've always been a proponent of it's okay and important to say, I don't know when you don't know. And because we don't know when that cliff is coming, that point of no return, it's critical that we act now, we act quickly for the benefit of mitigating future impacts.
And speaking of that, we're going to have some information in just a moment about some of the things that the DNR is doing and has been doing in a very active sense in that regard. But Kenny, again, coming back to the question of what you say to those who deny the notion of human-driven climate change.
Well, I mean, you know, they come at it from a number of different angles. And, you know, we're a scientific and science-based organization. We're trained scientists, and our job is to, you know, it's not like we conduct all of the research that we are then kind of distilling for various audiences. Our job is to distill the science. And frequently, the best way to do that is to read the larger assessments that have been done and then look at the peer-reviewed research that supports it. And then when you don't have any answers for a particular question, use the best available data and analysis. We can always fall back on that. We're scientists. And we would say this is what science shows. If you've got another idea that comes from another framework of seeing the world, okay, but our job is to report on the science. That's one piece, and honestly, sometimes that's even more combative than what's needed, because a lot of times, you know, we aren't political appointees, and a lot of times what happens is people come into this discussion because it is a political discussion for so many people. Mm-hmm. And we're actually just talking about facts that are totally apolitical. They're not political at all. And a lot of times, you know, it's helped for me to talk to some people in some areas where we're not really talking about climate change, and I put up quotes around that. We're just talking about what we've observed weather with changes in the weather and what you may have observed as, you know, farmers or as people who work outside or as, you know, just citizens of the state. And a lot of times if we just describe the same things we've been talking about, but we're not pushing this is climate change and this is, you know, your fault. And instead we're just saying this is what, you know, we've observed shorter winters with fewer cold extremes, longer and somewhat erratic growing seasons, more precipitation. A lot of times people in the audiences will say, well, yeah, I've seen that. I've had more water in my fields, or I absolutely haven't seen growing seasons like this. I've never seen field work and, you know, being done in October, late October, the way I've seen now. And then it sort of opens them up to ask the question, so what is it that you're talking about? And then we can discuss, we're talking about the science of climate change. And that's very different from, you know, the policy directives that might come out of it. That's just the experience that I've had, is that if you kind of lead with the evidence and the facts and make it a little bit about the stories that people might experience, they can relate to it pretty well.
Yeah, and I think anybody can really accept that perspective and in approaching it that way, appreciate that. We've got a number of good examples on the DNR website from DNR employees and others around the state, some of the impacts that they've been noticing in their daily lives, their professional lives, and their recreation. You can go to mndnr.gov/climate and select climate change to access some of those stories from Minnesotans and some other really helpful information. And in a minute, I'm going to talk a little bit. I have some questions for you about approaching freezing temperatures and getting into the cold season now, and overall what we mean when we talk about, you know, winter's getting warmer and some of those things. So think about that for a moment as I just highlight some of the things that the DNR has been doing to deal with climate change. They've been doing a lot, and it's something the agency takes very seriously. So 10 years ago, in 2009, we formed a department-wide climate team known as CREST to help us create operational principles around climate change. One of the first things they did was develop a climate change handbook for the DNR. We should also mention the DNR has been actively involved in climate adaptation and mitigation on all of the land that we administer around the state. In terms of mitigation, we proactively manage lands to capture and store carbon and minimize greenhouse gases. In forests, this means planting and seeding thousands of acres every year to accelerate reforestation after a harvest or a natural disturbance. We're also planting different species of trees that will do better in these changing conditions. We adjust conservation focus areas to incorporate more grass and cover crops. On adaptation, we proactively manage invasive species and enact policies to minimize climate change impacts on ecosystems. For example, implementing an ash forest diversification project to prepare for emerald ash borer infestations. We're adapting to more frequent flooding by redesigning culverts to accommodate higher flows and connect rivers to their floodplains. And we're working with partners all over the state and in other states as well, government agencies, local governments, all kinds of groups that are involved on this issue and engaged in urban planning, rural planning, flood management planning, and all the different things that we've been talking about today. Those are just a few examples, and there are many more. You can find a downloadable PDF fact sheet if you'd like to go to that same web location again, mndnr.gov/climate, and select climate change. So as we move toward this winter season now, and the way I see it put here, the length of the frost-free season is increasing over time and is expected to continue to increase through the century. So as we transition now from focus on water to a little more focus on temperature, what would you say are the big picture things for people to know as far as how winter weather is being affected?
Yes, so there's a few things that we can comment on right away. And you brought up the issue of frost-free season. The frost-free season refers to the length of time between the final frost in the spring to the first frost in the fall. And we've noticed that that period of time has increased roughly about 1 week across the state, a little bit higher in some parts of the states and a little bit lower in others.
Over what period of time are we talking about for that change?
Back to like the end of the 19th century.
Okay. Right, 1895.
All right. And so a week's difference in that,
right,
in that period of time.
Exactly. Right. So this could have profound impacts on our winter recreation and tourism industry. People take winter seriously here in Minnesota. I lived for a number of years in Louisiana where they didn't have snow, and they would actually relish if they just got a dusting of snow. Mm. People here make a living in the winter, whether it's through ice fishing or cross-country skiing or just going out and enjoying the winter cabins. The amount of time that we have with winter is important to us, and so these observations are being taken seriously.
Kenny, any key figures you'd cite, or just things you're hearing commonly from people as you're out talking with people around the state?
I mean, you know, we could focus on the statistics, But a lot of times they're hard for people to understand. So yeah. We say, oh, winter's been warming over the long term at a half a degree Fahrenheit per decade. What does that really mean for people? Well, we can then translate that into some of the observations that we've gotten from people on the ground who aren't necessarily using thermometers to tell us what they've seen. A few years ago, we started getting calls, kind of distressed calls, and it was a bit alarming from resort owners and people who were representing and or writing about sort of the outdoor recreation in Minnesota, especially northern Minnesota, have been hit really hard because, you know, people who own resorts, their big time is the summer, but they get a sort of second season in the winter. And in the winter, it's about ice fishing. And if you can get people out who want to go fishing on your lake, then they will, you know, book cabins in advance. And if they book a cabin in advance, they might even need some help getting an ice house out onto the lake. Maybe they'll rent one. Maybe they'll rent a snowmobile. Maybe they'll buy, you know, refreshments too. And when they become uncertain if they're going to have ice, they cancel their reservations. And nobody's going up to these places, you know, because you can't hang out by the beach. So if there's no ice, people aren't going up. Yep. And we started getting, because of the frequency of those warmer winters and the less dependable ice season, we were starting to see effects of that on some of the, you know, the cabin industry, resorts and whatnot. But then we've also heard from, you know, people who operate ski hills. They really need not just dependable snow, because of course they can make their own snow. But to make their own snow, they need a range of temperatures that's ideal for making snow. And if the temperature is above the highest part of that range, they can't do much with it. And so there's been a lot of concern. And of course, people have seen, you know, canceled kind of major events in the region, the Birkebeiner, some of the dog sled races, some of the local cross-country ski races like the Twin Cities Lope, being canceled. Even winter carnivals being canceled because, you know, you don't have the conditions. So we can tie that to numbers, a half a degree increase in winter temperature over the last 120 some years, half a degree increase per decade. But what it really means is, you know, shorter winters, as Luigi mentioned, less ice on the lakes, or at least a lower frequency or a shorter ice over season. And then somewhat puzzlingly, even though we've actually had the same amount of snow or even more snow during that time, the warmer conditions have really prevented us from realizing a real bountiful snow pack for much of that season. So it's actually, we can sort of tie it together numerically and also anecdotally.
We're moving toward the end of our time here, and we'll move toward some closing thoughts. I'm wondering how people can learn more and certainly the resources like the DNR website provide some good basic information, but I don't know if either of you have other sources other than yourselves that you would recommend to people. And Kenny, I know, you both worked on a development of an online data tool that people can access to find out more specifics about what's happening and some of the trends that are happening in different parts of the state. Maybe that's something that you might want to reference.
Yeah, so we have an online climate trends tool that it's really one of many. So this was kind of a large project, and people can click on any part of the state and can get the trend, or maybe it's no trend. They can see what's happened over time for temperature, precipitation, and some combined metrics for either an entire sort of year by year, or for a subset of months within a year, or for just, say, the growing season or just winter. And they can do it if they're interested in watersheds or counties. They can do it from a number of choices. And that, you know, I had mentioned we don't have a real simple URL for that, but Greg, what's the best way to find it?
And again, just going to mndnr.gov/climate.
Yeah.
And you'll find those resources and that tool there.
Now, for deeper, we have a lot of friends and colleagues who really like to dive deep, and Luigi and his predecessor have made some great tools that are, you know, kind of a station-by-station basis You want to describe some of those, Luigi?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of these are map-based tools that allow users to click on a station, a location, whether it's Rochester or Albert Lea or Minneapolis or up north near Fargo or Grand Forks, and observe trends in precipitation or temperature. We have tools that show the year-to-date precipitation for different stations across the state. We have tools that show temperature and precipitation monthly anomalies. We had a really long trend of warm temperatures, warm monthly temperatures here in the metro. What was it, Kenny? Was it 20?
We had 20 months.
20 months in a row, and it ended the month after I started as the state climatologist here. I cursed it. But so lovely tools that were started by Jim Zandlow, continued on with Greg Spoden, and I've tried to hold up the tradition, and Kenny's done a great job with his climate trends tools. So we're very proud of all of those.
Well, we certainly greatly appreciate your expertise, not just your time here, but on an ongoing basis. It's meant so much to the DNR to have the State Climatology Office here as part of our Ecological and Water Resources Division. Thank you, Dr. Kenny Blumenfeld and Dr. Luigi Romolo, for providing your expertise and your perspectives here on this podcast. Thank you for joining us for this podcast. I'm Greg Husak. You've been listening to A Conversation About Climate Change, featuring experts from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. To learn more about climate change in Minnesota, visit the DNR's website at mndnr.gov/climatechange.